It's time for Let's Talk Legal with your hosts, Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins from the law firm of Harvell & Collins. If you've got a legal question, they can give you the answer. Call now, 1-800-818-2255, and Let's Talk Legal.
Let's Talk Legal with Harvell & Collins, attorneys at law here on the Talk Station. You can reach us and ask your questions right now, too. But Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins are in the studio. Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning, Ben.
Good morning, Ben.
Good to have you here with us here today. So,
we are right here.
What are we talking about today?
Ben, last week, Wes and I spoke about will caveats.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, this is really a fascinating area of the practice in terms of just the various dynamics that can, the factual scenarios, if you will, that mm-hmm. could come into play. You, of course, mentioned before we went on the air this morning, Ben, you know, suppose someone dies without a will and someone qualifies as the administrator of the estate, which is what we call it when
right. We
do not have a will.
Exactly.
They have the same duties as an executor, but because we have no will, they're called an administrator.
Mm-hmm.
And then a couple years goes by, or maybe just a year goes by, and then all of a sudden we find a will.
Mm-hmm.
And yet the estate has been fully administered under the laws of intestate succession and not pursuant to the will. Okay, now we don't have to answer that question right now, but hey, those are some facts that occasionally happen.
Mm-hmm.
Suppose we have a will that goes on record, and then we are in the process of probating that will, transferring assets according to that will.
Mm-hmm.
6 months goes by, a year goes by, and we find a will that was dated later.
Right.
Okay.
A subsequent will.
Or a codicil or amendment to the will that is under probate. That completely changes the disposition.
Right.
So all of these things are out there. Let's just start by saying, hey, it's awfully important for these things to not be there, by the way, which is why all our listeners need to go to a good attorney and get a good and up-to-date will and make sure that it is accurate and depicts exactly what they want it to say. Now, of course, will caveats, that means that that is a challenge to the will itself, to the document, to the document itself.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, many times it can be based on undue influence.
Right.
That the testator was under undue influence. It can be based on the fact that the testator was not competent, was incompetent, did not understand the nature of his estate and the nature of his beneficiaries, and therefore the provisions in the will are not accurate because the testator wasn't competent, didn't know what he was signing.
Right.
Okay. Those are some pretty common reasons for there to be a caveat. There can be other reasons, such as, for instance, that, you know, those witnesses really weren't there. They say they were there and saw the testator sign, but they weren't. I mean, suppose we have a witness on a will, John Doe, but we find out that at the time the will was signed, John Doe was, in fact, not living.
Right.
You know, that's a problem. You do have to have two witnesses to a will in the state of North Carolina, and then those two witnesses need to sign in the presence of a notary. So there are any number of ways or reasons why a will would go under caveat. And once it goes under caveat, then that means that all actions under the will stop. Okay? They have to stop, Ben, because, you know, after all, what if we distribute assets to A, B, and C, and
right.
we find that the will isn't valid? Well, after we've distributed the assets to A, B, and C, it's going to be awfully hard to get them back
right.
and distribute them according to the manner in which they should be distributed. So with that said, there is a procedure before the courts to caveat a will, and so I'll let Wes now take us through some of those procedures or the procedure.
Right.
Yeah. Let me add a couple things to what Cecil said as far as, you know, the actual will itself and the execution of the will. you know, anyone can challenge a will if you have standing.
Right.
Meaning you are in a position to take under the will or under intestate succession in the will that in the event that the will is set aside. So, you know, good attorneys are always going to be very keen to the possibility that there may be a challenge. So, you know, we're always going to make sure that we have the two disinterested witnesses in the room, watching the signature at the time, watching the execution. We're always going to ask questions about, you know, who is your family? You know, what property do you have? How do you want it to pass? All these kind of things. For folks who are signing a will, executing a will, who, you know, maybe there's a question about their capacity, then the good practice is to then contact their attorney or get, or I'm sorry, their doctor, and get a letter from the doctor relative to their capacity. Now, 99 times out of 100, you know, the clients that you meet with are clearly, they clearly have that capacity.
Right.
They
right.
clearly know what they want. They clearly are in a position where they can decide where their assets are to go, who their family is, what assets they have. So it's not necessary under those 99 out of 100 situations to go get a doctor letter every time. But
right.
if it's a close call, that is, you know, a good practice. So, and the reason we do that, obviously, is because we have a duty, you know, to make sure this person does have the capacity. Now, we're not medical doctors, but within, you know, reasonable standard, we do have that duty to look into that. And we want to, you know, keep this document that we're involved with just as solid as we can. And that's really part of the service we're providing for the client. You know, we're not just getting a piece of paper signed here.
Yeah.
This is a will. I mean, this is a very important document in this person's life. You know, the other thing that I think is important to mention, in North Carolina, North Carolina does not support no contest clauses. Now, sometimes you see these. You see provisions in a will that says, in the event that you contest this will, you don't get anything.
Right. And,
okay.
So you can't do that in the will.
You can contest it anyway. The cases in North Carolina state that if you have any reasonable basis whatsoever for contesting it, then the clause is not going to be enforceable against you as it relates to your inheritance. So that's a pretty, you know, low standard as far as being able to contest it. Now, some states, they completely support no contest clause. If you contest, you don't take. Now, there's not that many of those states, but there are some states that follow that.
Now, who determines who has standing to contest? Is that all the clerk?
No. And I think we're back to procedure now.
Right.
Because what happens with regard to a will caveat is obviously the will is put on record. The estate is proceeding. That's all in the clerk's office. That's all original jurisdiction with the clerk of court in the county in which the estate is pending. As soon as a caveat is filed, the case is then transferred to the Superior Court because this is a jury issue. You know, the clerk of court doesn't have the authority to preside over that. And by statute, it goes to the Superior Court, and a separate order is entered staying or basically freezing the estate assets but allowing for general administration, pay the taxes, pay the mortgage, you know, whatever needs to be paid from the estate. But then the Superior Court judge, whoever is presiding at the time, then has the authority to make all decisions in the case with regard to motions to dismiss because of lack of standing, summary judgment motions, any other type of motions in the case, discovery motions, anything that is proceeding in the case, the Superior Court judge is then going to have the authority to make decisions, you know, on those things, because we're now in basically lawsuit mode.
Right.
As I mentioned last week, it's not really, you know, plaintiff versus defendant, like, you know, John Smith versus Sister Sally Smith, because I think Sally Smith got mom to sign the will. No, that's not the way it works. You file a caveat, and then all the parties get aligned. These two support the will. These three don't support the will. And off we go. That's kind of the way it works. Now,
and a jury's decision is only that this will is valid or not valid.
So only that's the only issue that the jury considers in a caveat. You know, they consider whether it's valid or not. Now, it could be on several bases. You could have, we kind of jumped to the end of the trial now,
right.
But we'll come back since you asked that question. You know, when you try a case and you get to the end of the case, there are issues that are submitted to the jury. And that's normally in the form of what's called a verdict sheet, because the jury mm-hmm. is going to enter a verdict, hopefully unanimous one way or another on different issues. So usually in a will caveat, the issues that are going to be submitted to the jury are going to be something like, did the testator have capacity to enter the will? Was the testator, was the will a product of undue influence? Did the witnesses,
mm-hmm.
see the execution of the will? That may be a little bit more of a legal issue, but it could be a factual issue. So these kind of things, because in the event the jury comes back on any of those in support of something that would invalidate the will falls.
Mm-hmm.
It's gone. But to go back, back up a little bit as to when this is filing, the parties are becoming aligned.
Yeah.
Counsels on both sides. I mean, a caveat proceeding. I've never seen one without attorneys on both sides, by the way.
Mm-hmm. Right.
My advice regarding that is if you think you're going to handle one by yourself, don't do it. They're a little bit complicated.
Yeah.
But nevertheless, the process is really very similar to a standard lawsuit, that we've talked about on this program.
Mm-hmm.
Discovery is going to proceed.
Mm-hmm.
There are going to be interrogatories, requests for production of documents, requests for admissions that are going to be served. These are formal discovery mechanisms under the North Carolina Rules of Civil Procedure, which do apply to caveat proceedings.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to get answers to these questions. We're going to get the medical records. We're going to find out, who would say that this person, who are their friends, who was around them,
mm-hmm.
how are they doing at this point in time. So we're going to start off on that crusade of discovery to get the story, to get the facts.
We'll come back to that in just a moment here on Let's Talk Legal with Harvell and Collins. Your questions are welcome at 800-818-2255, 247-7282, or 353-4674. Welcome back to Let's Talk Legal with Harvell and Collins, Attorneys at Law, and we have Daniel in Jacksonville on the line with us this morning. Good morning, Daniel. How are you?
Yeah, good morning. How are you doing this morning?
Doing fine.
I got a question. It's a little different. It's concerning a trust. And in that trust, there is a clause, a no contest clause. And it basically says that if anybody in the trust, beneficiary and or trustee, contest the trust, that they're basically out of it. They don't get anything. And all, and I was reading this, 350 pages long, the trust, and even in the no contest, it has four or five pages, even so much as conspiracy to contest, blah, blah, blah.
Mm-hmm.
But I just wanted to get him to comment on that. Mm-hmm. And, in North Carolina, is that, legal to have that in a trust, no contest?
Daniel, that's a great question. And I tell you, I have researched this issue extensively in the context of wills. And as I stated just a moment ago, North Carolina really doesn't support no contest clause in wills. Now, sir, I have not really researched that issue as it relates to a trust issue.
Mm-hmm.
Trusts, of course, are different than wills. Mm-hmm. They're handled under North Carolina General Statute 36C in general. But I tell you what I'll do with regard to that. I'll look into that between now and next week be happy to give you a good researched answer on it, because I don't want to speculate about it. But I think that
right.
the courts are going to follow suit with how that's been addressed with the will cases I just mentioned.
It is a fascinating question. I know you didn't realize when you called in this morning you were going to give us such a great question, our friend from Jacksonville. This is my take on it. The law in North Carolina that does not support a will contest clause in a will is a public policy law that is basically, if we look behind it, saying, look, if there's something wrong with a last will and testament, then hey, let's let folks have their day in court. Let's let them have standing to come in and challenge a will, notwithstanding the fact that the will has a no contest clause. Public policy arguments are always arguments that kind of are like trump cards. I don't know whether I'm making sense there or not.
You know, Cecil,
Cecil
and Daniel, let me offer this. Some of the cases I've read with regard to this acknowledge the fact that a trust or a will, well, mainly a will, may have been procured through undue influence.
Correct.
Or fraud.
Right.
So the person perpetrating the fraud may have included a no contest clause.
Mm-hmm. Correct.
So the courts recognize that, and that is one of the main reasons why we want to give folks the opportunity to have their day in court with regard to a possible contest if there is any validity, any merit to it at all. And I think that would apply to trust, but I will do the research and mm-hmm. report back on the program in a week from right now.
Excellent. I'll be listening next week.
Okay. All right. Very good.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Daniel.
What I was just going to add, Ben, is that a trust, however, as we've discussed on this program, is a contract.
Mm-hmm.
It is a contract between the creator of the trust and the trustee of the trust. And it is and for the benefit of the beneficiaries. And it is a contract. And so the question, the issue that has been brought to the table is, you know, does this law still apply, the non-validity of a no-contest clause in a contract, okay, between the grantor and the trustee? And, of course, it's a very good question to look at.
But if the contract is procured through fraud that it is vitiated through from beginning to end,
correct,
including the no-contest clause.
That's mm-hmm. right.
So you do have a little bit of a gray area right here that I'm interested in and do want to look at and report back to Daniel.
Right.
All right. We'll get some more information on that and look forward to hearing the results of that research, too. As we come back here in just a moment on Let's Talk Legal with Harvell and Collins, Attorneys at Law, you can call in with a question still.
A call 800-818-2255, 247-7282, or 353-4674.
The law is increasingly complex, and the growing staff of Harvell & Collins stands ready to untangle your legal challenges. Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins, along with associates Russell Alexander and Andrew Foster, practicing in all areas of civil practice, including estate planning, elder law and asset protection, representation of the elderly, collections and foreclosures, corporate and business, and also civil trial practice in these and all other civil matters. Call to arrange your free initial consultation at 252-726-905. Plus, Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins answer your questions live each Tuesday morning at 7:30 on Let's Talk Legal. Tune in to Coastal Daybreak Tuesday mornings at 7:30 on the Talk Station and call in with your legal questions.
I had a property issue in the sense that I've got some pretty tall pine trees, and they're inside my fenced area, but my neighbor wants to cut down the trees, concerned that trees are going to fall over and damage a building that he's built. Can he do that?
If it's your question, it's important to Harvell and Collins, Attorneys at Law, 1107 Bridges Street in Moorhead City. Welcome back to Let's Talk Legal with Harvell & Collins, Attorneys at Law, again online at harvellandcollins.com as we finish up the program.
Right. We're talking about will caveats. Mm-hmm. Daniel, you know, had a great question. We'll come back to that. Where were we on will caveats? He took us down such a great path there. I don't remember
exactly
where we
were.
Well,
we were talking about procedures and where we go. And you were through the parts
discovery.
About discovery and all that.
That's right.
And I asked the question off air about whether or not you had to have a unanimous jury, and that's an interesting side.
Right. Well, civil case, you know, your verdict is going to be unanimous one way or another.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in the event they don't come back unanimous, then it's hung on the issue and it's a hung jury, then it would have to be retried on that issue. If the caveator wants to retry, the caveator could decide, well, I couldn't convince this jury of 12,
mm-hmm.
so I don't want to go through the process again, and then the old will stands. Now, we did talk about 10 or greater as well. This is kind of you know, this is just
a sidebar here to
boots on the ground kind of stuff as far as the way juries work. Mm-hmm. You know, normally when you're trying a case, before you get started with the actual trial, but you've gone through voir dire and you've picked your 12 jurors, if it's a 12-juror case, which most are in North Carolina, the judge normally gives the attorneys an opportunity to have 10 or more, a verdict of 10 or more. Mm-hmm. And, you know, what that's about is you might lose a juror. You might have one that gets sick. You might have, you know, things happen.
Mm-hmm.
So we don't want the jurors to sit there for several days and spend their time, and then all of a sudden, you know, we don't have 12 anymore, so we can't have a verdict. So the attorneys normally agree with 10 or more, so that if you have at least 10, it's got to be unanimous.
Right.
Okay, but you have at least 10 as far as your verdict goes, then you do have a good verdict. Now, you can also pick an alternate.
Mm-hmm.
But as I was mentioning off the air, then the alternate has to sit there just like the other 12.
Right.
Listen to all the facts, listen to the evidence. But then they get to do nothing.
They're not in the deliberation at all either, right?
Yes. Right. And that's not my preference.
Yeah.
I mean, I'd rather do 10 or more usually.
Okay.
So,
but again, in the will caveat, you're looking at trying to establish whether or not this will is valid, and then does it automatically go to another? If another will is being presented, does it automatically turn to that one?
Well, that's an interesting issue, because if you have usually a well drafted will is going to say, it's going to state that this will revokes all prior wills and codicils.
Mm-hmm.
So if you find a subsequent will that surfaces,
right,
and is valid, it has all the witnesses it needs to have, it has the correct language, then it is going to automatically trump that previous will.
Mm-hmm.
There's not going to be a caveat. It's just that we have, you know,
right,
the will.
Mm-hmm.
This is the will. Now, I have had a case in which we found a subsequent will that did not have language in it indicating that it revoked prior wills.
Yeah.
And codicils. It said this revokes prior wills, but didn't say anything about prior codicils.
Uh-huh.
And there was a prior codicil.
Right.
That made a huge difference in what my client received.
Hmm.
Okay, so
then we have to
read them both together.
Right.
You know, very, very interesting, you know, how that works.
Hmm. So, well, again, this is all the more reason why you call on folks like Carvel and Collins, attorneys at law, to get you the right advice at the right time. You can give them a call at 252-726-9050. Again, 252-726-9050, 1107 Bridges Street in Morehead City, and online at harvellandcollins.com.